Welcome to the Marketing for Business podcast. This is your host, Scott Wilson.
Doug Gould, welcome to the Marketing for Business podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
I'm excited by this chat. Like, I've heard you're the chairman of ideas. That's what I've heard. Is that true?
I don't believe everything you hear, Scott.
Hey, well, you know, we've had Mike and your business partner on the podcast, and obviously you guys were highly successful, in the media company that you created. And we'll talk about that. You know, you had, you know, a global office with NRS Media. You had 200 staff, 6 offices, 23 countries that you operated in, 11 different languages, and sold it for, you know, a good sum of money. And so I'm excited to talk about that. But I'm also excited to learn how you got into radio and started More FM, which for some people they'll really remember. And also, but first I wanted to go back and talk a little bit about your background. I heard you were a bit of a copywriter.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, I got into radio purely by accident.
Yep.
I was working at the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries of all places, stamping seed certification certificates. And one of the places I went to at the time was a local radio station.
Yep.
I had no great interest in radio or great desire to get into radio. Anyway, I was so bored of what I was doing, and they rang me up one day because I'd left my name and contact details there, and they said, oh, would you like to set a coffee test?
Yeah.
And I was too embarrassed to ask what a coffee test was. Say,
what was a coffee test?
Yeah, and I thought maybe it's making coffee for the announcers or something like that, but I was too embarrassed to ask what it was, and I was so desperate to get out of the job I was in that I said, I'll sit anything. So I went, and of course it was a copy test where I had to write commercials, and I had to write one 150-word commercial, and the subject line was oranges.
Oh, wow.
No more. And I had to write a 15-second commercial, and they gave me a whole sheet of information, probably about 400 or 500 words, and I had to distill that into a 15-second commercial. So, yeah, so I got into a job as a copywriter in radio, writing commercials.
Was that something you were naturally good at, like, or did you learn that over time?
No, I've always enjoyed writing as such, but I never had any particular desire to either get into radio or into copywriting. But once I was in there, I loved it. I mean, I still love the radio industry and never left.
Yeah.
From a copy's perspective, like we're like obviously writing sales, right? And getting people, were you creating the jingle type of thing as well?
Like creating, you know, in those days, not a lot of commercials were recorded. Most of them are live spoken reads because it was, technology in those days made it more difficult to do a lot of recorded commercials. Yep. So most of them are live reads, but some jingles and in commercials for all sorts of different types of local businesses.
Brilliant. Do you remember any of the top of your head that were really, really hit it out of the gate with? Like, is something you're really proud of?
Oh yeah, I did a great series of commercials for Dallas Motors in Dunedin.
Yep.
I was in Dunedin for a while. I did some for a company called Haynes Eddy in Greymouth, and I still got the tape of that.
Cool.
That was a recorded one. So, there's a few that stick in your mind.
What did that sort of grounding teach you about the whole industry to start? You know, because it kind of, I guess, some degree, you're starting at the real coalface.
At the bottom.
Yeah,
at the bottom.
I don't want to say that.
the lowest grade copywriter there was.
Yeah.
But what I learned was what a dynamic industry it was.
Yep.
and the sort of people in it were interesting and they were very vibrant. So I really just got into that feeling of radio, and I thought, gee, I love this industry. I was going to be a school teacher. That was what set out to be when I left school and went to university.
Yep.
But then when I got to university, I realized that there are a lot of other things out there, and I wasn't sure that university is the teaching was what I wanted to do. So
did you complete your university studies?
No, I left because I was on a secondary teacher studentship at that time where they paid you a small amount of money, but for every year you were paid that money, you had to teach.
Yeah.
So if you went to university for 3 years, you had to teach for 3 years. And I thought, gee, not sure that I really want to teach for three years. So that's when I got out and ended up in it by accident in radio.
How good. So learning, what are some of the things you take away from those learnings early on? I mean, anything that sticks out for you that really stood you in good? Like, did you have a mentor at the time or?
Yeah, I had a couple of mentors that had quite a lot of influence on the way I developed. I mean, initially, all I did was focus on writing commercials, but it was the industry itself that really got to me.
Because that was kind of like radio was really starting to take off.
It was. I mean, it was, when I first started, it was, you know, the old NZBC, where it was very bureaucratic. It was a government controlled, of course. And there were a lot of bureaucratic processes and, you know, a lot of rules to follow, which I didn't really relate to particularly well. So it's changed a lot since then, of course.
Yeah, totally. So how do you then go from, like, writing the copy to owning or starting another station? Like, what was the thinking there? Spot a gap?
No. I mean, I'd like to think there was some sort of master plan, but no, it all happened by accident.
Yeah.
I went to Greymouth, of all places, and I'm actually going there tomorrow for a radio reunion.
Oh, cool.
I went to Greymouth as a copywriter, writing commercials, but the sales manager who was there at the time was so incompetent and no advertisers wanted to deal with him that I really took over the sales function as well as writing commercials.
Yep.
And I was there for a year or 18 months and then took a job in Dunedin as the, I think, some grand title like assistant copy supervisor or something, which was essentially just a writer. And about a year later, the sales manager in Greymouth was forced out and they rang me and said, oh, would you like to go into sales? And I said, I've never thought about it. And they said, well, you know, you did well in sales while you were here as a copywriter, and were writing more business than the sales manager. And I said, oh, I'll give it a go. Why not?
Brilliant.
And so I got into sales, and then I went back to Greymouth for a third time as a relieving station manager.
What company was this for?
This was still for the NZBC.
NZBC.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, still the old government
organisation.
And I went back a third time as relieving station manager, and I think they just wanted to test me out to see if I was any good, you know, sort of a management role. And I was there for 3 or 4 months. And then I got a job as general manager of 2ZM in Wellington. And from there, went to managing director of Radio Windy. And then in 1991, the government opened up all of the radio frequencies and put them out for tender. And in this time, I'd realised that I really wanted to go my own way. And I thought I'd built up enough knowledge and
expertise. Why was that? Was that you just didn't like the structures inside those businesses?
No, look, in the case of NZBC, I mean, quite honestly, I left before I was thrown out because I didn't really relate to the sort of the bureaucracy that existed there, and there were so many restrictions and so many processes to go through to get anything done that I got really frustrated.
Yep.
So I sort of rebelled against the head office structure, and I left before I was thrown out
the door
is essentially the truth. And I got a job at Radio Windy, which is private radio, private enterprise, and I really enjoyed that. And I would have probably stayed there, but they had some structural changes within that company that left me a bit disillusioned and dissatisfied. So when the radio frequencies came up for tender, I said to a business partner, well, a partner that was in at Radio Windy at the time, Craig Thompson, I said to him, why don't we go out and do our own thing?
So essentially selling those licenses was an opportunity for someone to tender for that. Was it a frequency at the time?
Yeah. They tendered for frequencies and it was all the frequencies nationwide. So that was there was a lot of luck involved in that. Yeah. And that's never happened again.
I was going to say it's never happened again. No.
I mean, odd frequencies have come up for sale, but this was the wholesale tendering of all of the available frequencies in New Zealand.
Yeah. So right time, right place. Did you have an idea, right, okay, we're going to start this? Did you have a plan of okay, if we get an opportunity, here's what we'd do? Like,
had a pretty clear idea of, I mean, a lot of it was based on what was wrong with NZBC and what was wrong with the Radio Windy structure. I thought, if I ever do my own thing, there are certain things I won't do.
Yeah.
But I also had a clear idea in my mind in terms of what we wanted to create, and that was based around, you know, great staff and giving them the freedom to do their own thing, giving them, because one of the things that I found in Radio New Zealand and to a lesser extent at Windy, I mean, you were in a straitjacket.
Yes.
You know, you if you made a mistake, you know, everybody was on top of you.
Yes.
And I've always been one, I've never been frightened of making mistakes, and I've made more errors than most people I know. Fear of failure is never a reason to do something.
Totally, totally.
So I wanted to create an environment where people felt free to exercise their own creativity.
That's so cool.
And do things their own way.
Yeah.
And so I had a really clear idea of what I wanted to try and create.
It's interesting because, you know, like we hire and we're talking to the young people these days, and it's really interesting that some of those hierarchies and some of those bigger agencies where these young people now don't actually get to be that creative because you can't even talk to the creative director. You know, they sit up in their ivory towers. I just think, you know, it's the greatest thing ever working with, you know, great staff and getting and letting them do their own thing, get out of their own way. I always say hire people, good people, and get out of their way.
I agree. Let them blossom,
you know.
I mean, my philosophy was never to create rules, but to create parameters.
Nice, yeah.
You know, so that people can work within a space as long as they do so within the bounds of ethics and legality.
Yeah.
You know, let them do their own thing. I mean, if a person is faced with a brick wall and the objective is to get to the other side, you know, I mean, someone will get a ladder and climb over the top.
Yeah.
Someone will bury a tunnel underneath it.
Yeah, totally.
You know, someone might sneak around the side.
Yeah.
And someone will just bash the thing down.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
They get to the other side. As long as they've done so within those parameters.
Mm.
So you're giving them some flexibility. Yeah. And
that was, I guess, your thing is your point of difference, right? So you could.
It was really at the time, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And starting to attract people that want to be part of that vision?
Like, that was a big part of it because, you know, people knew they would never be criticised for trying something, be criticised. There's no retribution.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody did something wrong, you certainly didn't expect them to do it wrong twice.
No, same thing. No.
But if you give them that creative flexibility to do things their way, because, you know, quite honestly, my way is not always right.
Yeah.
My way is the way I would do it.
Yeah.
But I don't want to impose my way on everybody else.
No, exactly.
So give them that that flexibility.
So in the day, you got More FM, or you got the frequency, and did you call it More? Like, what was your thinking behind how that all came together?
Well, originally we got a frequency in Wellington, and we called it Capital City FM. We got a frequency in Christchurch, and we called it Canterbury FM. We got a frequency in Auckland. I think we called it Auckland FM. Very creative.
But, and what was the FM part?
The frequency, FM frequency.
Oh, FM frequency. Yeah, cool.
We tossed around a whole lot of names. And funnily enough, it was James Daniels from Christchurch.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
We hired James and Ken, who were the top rating breakfast show on ZM in Christchurch, and we were having a dinner with them one night. This was, and this was all very secretive at the time because, you know, they had to give 6 months' notice or whatever, and they gave their 6 months' notice, and we kept quiet about who we'd hired.
Oh wow!
And we were having a dinner one night, and it was James's wife at the time who said, "We're talking about names, what we should call it." She said, "Why don't you call it More FM? Everybody wants more." You know, more music.
Nice.
And, so, I mean, I'd like to claim credit, but I can't. Go. And that's how the name came about. And it's been More FM ever since.
Yeah, good. Any issues setting it up or anything happened?
Huge issues. Look, there was, because nobody knew we were bidding for frequencies, we created a company which was spelt WHANNALYSENTS.
Yeah.
Which no one had ever heard of this country, you know, and everybody's trying to work out what it was. Well, if you say it phonetically, it's won a license.
Yeah.
But nobody made that connection, won a license, and we remain completely anonymous. We got a Dunedin legal firm to bid on our behalf, told nobody, absolutely secretive all the way through. People asked if we were, you know, bidding for free, asked me if I was bidding for a frequency, and I just pushed the thing out. I said, oh, no, I don't think I could afford it. so we sneaked in.
Yeah.
And nobody had any idea that we had bid. And when we were successful, both Radio New Zealand at the time and Brierley's, who owned Radio Windy and a number of other stations, were determined to shut us down.
Yeah.
Because I think they realised that we could have been a threat. And fortunately, we did end up being a threat.
Yeah, yeah.
And they had a lot of money, and we had no money. I mean, we had to mortgage our houses, and we had no financial backing. We had no big investors.
Did they see as a threat because you were just savvy at what you were doing?
I think they knew. Look, I mean, I think over the years I'd built up a bit of a reputation, and I think, you know, I had a lot of knowledge about the industry.
Yeah.
I had great relationships with key staff.
Yeah.
And I knew a lot of people, well, I felt confident a lot of people would want to work in this environment.
Yeah, yeah.
As it happened, they did.
They did.
But they chose to take legal action against us. And part of the rationale, I'm sure, was that, you know,
slow them up.
We didn't have the money, they did.
Yeah.
So they, you know, we went into this.
Didn't try and come by us straight off or anything like that?
No. They didn't do that. Tried to shut us down. And tried to get an injunction against us to starting because, you know, quite frankly, if we'd have been held up for 3 or 4 weeks, you know, that would have destroyed us. We would never have made it.
You were getting ad revenue coming in.
Yeah, we had advertising. Well, we had no revenue coming in. This is before we went to air.
Oh, wow.
And we had staff, staff employed.
Oh.
We had to pay them, but we were getting no money coming in. So it was all money going out. And, you know, another 4 weeks delay probably would have, would have killed us. But, we had one lawyer and they had five, at the court hearing.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to shut us down because they claimed that somehow we had prior knowledge of what they were bidding.
All right. Were they bidding after the same?
Yeah, they were going for the same frequencies, yeah.
And how was the bidding? Was it done in a silent way, an auction?
It was a crazy system where it was the highest bid won, but they only played the second highest price. Consultants came in and advised the government. So the top bidder got the frequency, and
so if you had to pay $5 million, the other person was prepared to pay
one. Then you paid one. Yeah,
far out.
It was ridiculous. Yeah. But their rationale was that people would bid more, knowing they'd never have to pay that price. But that defies logic because if particularly in our case, we knew we could only afford a certain amount and that's what we bid. So, but we got it for a much lower price.
And how you wouldn't know competitors' bids anyway? Like, what's
of course not. I mean, I left Windy 6 months before the frequencies were put up for tender, so there's no way I could.
So it got
known.
Chucked out straight away, or like,
yeah, well, it did. Yeah, the judge chucked it out and then they discontinued the case, and we just got on with.
Yeah, good.
With business. So, yeah, so there was a lot of stress, I guess.
Oh, there would have been.
In terms of setting it up.
So you've got your license, you got staff in there. Where's your head going as far as, geez, I've got to generate some revenue here.
Sometimes necessity, creates opportunity. And we didn't have the cash. And we'd mortgaged our houses. Could get no bank finance and had no investors. So, and we had staff, and we obviously had some great staff.
Yeah.
So we had to pay them well to get them in the first place. So the dilemma for us was, we could sell advertising, and we pre-sold a lot of advertising. Yeah. But the problem is in radio, you broadcast it in month one, you might get paid in month two.
Yeah.
You probably get paid at month three, yeah, and yeah, you're going to have some advertisers who don't pay until month four because they've got other priorities. So we need to create a way in which we could generate cash flow right from the start.
Yeah.
So I came up with this idea of selling unsold time, but selling it as packages of image advertising, because image advertising doesn't have to run today or tomorrow. It doesn't have to run.
Be running any time.
It can be running any time.
Yeah.
So we were able to fill up all of our unsold time with image advertising. Yeah. And we sold it. We called it the foundation advertiser plan, you know, for foundation advertisers. And we went out into the market very attractively priced, because at the end of the day, it was our unsold time.
Yeah.
So we priced it very aggressively, and we went out and said, you know, this is a fantastic deal for brand advertising.
Nice.
We knew it wouldn't cut across, you know, the traditional sales and special events and promotions, because, you know, those advertisers need to advertise on a specific day at a specific time.
So, to their market, totally.
Yeah, so, and it was building up their brand at the same time. So we said, look, this is a really good deal, but there are some conditions attached to it. One is you have to pay weekly in advance by automatic payment.
Yep.
And we sold $1.2 million worth of foundation advertiser plan before we even turned the microphone on.
Brilliant.
And in those days, that's going back to 1991,
$1.2
million was a lot of money in those days.
Probably was about 6 days, right?
Probably. Anyway, it more than covered our operating expenses for year one. So any additional advertising that came in was profit. So the first day.
So the chairman of ideas is actually probably, you know,
it's not
too far away, right?
Yeah, sometimes you get good ideas and sometimes they fail. But
how did you sell that? Well, did you go out and like?
Well, first of all, in year one, we had sales people hired 6 weeks before we went to air.
Yep.
So they went out to advertisers because they didn't have all the ongoing servicing and follow-up calls, et cetera, with clients, because all it was before we went to air was basically selling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in the first year, they went out and physically sold it, you know, face to face to businesses that we wanted to attract on radio. And as a result, the day we went to air, $120,000 rolled into our bank account, because they had to pay weekly in advance every week. $120,000 rolled in.
So good.
And we needed that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had to find a way.
Yeah.
In which we could generate that cash flow.
What a great use of your, you know, airtime that wasn't being.
Yeah, well, exactly. It just made sense.
It made sense. But also that keeping that brand rolling, right? Like, it's a great.
Exactly. Yeah.
Real win-win.
It worked well. Yeah. But the second year, just to finish off on how we sold it. In the second year, we realized there's a lot of money attached to it. So we had to carry it on. To put our salespeople out selling that, you know, for 4 weeks or three or four weeks would have a big impact on revenue.
Yep.
So I thought, well, how can we do this more cost efficiently, where it doesn't involve, you know, a whole month of every salesperson time going out to do it? So that's when we came up the idea of doing seminars, small seminars, you know, 10 advertisers at a time. So we did it in a week. We did less than a week because it was sold out after about 3.5 days.
Brilliant.
And we had a waiting list. So that was, once again, that was driven by a need.
Yeah.
We had to find a more efficient way of generating the revenue. So the way to do that, you know, was small group seminars where the advertisers came in.
Yeah.
Did
they know what they were coming for? Like, was there hey, you're coming along to get a...
No, there's a bit of intrigue involved there. I mean, you know, you don't want to make it, you know, a lot of them knew it was a follow-up to the foundation advertiser plan, but you can't have foundation advertiser plan 2 years in a row because they're no longer advertising.
And were you educating the market as well? Like, was your seminar about?
Well, educating about the importance of brand advertising,
Brilliant.
You know, how to use brand advertising.
Do you remember what you were saying? What sort of...
Yeah, well, it was all about, you know, brand advertising as a, you know, as a longer term strategy. You need consistency.
Nice.
It's not about frequency. It's about being there all the time. Yeah, it's about being consistent, you know, week in, week out, month in, month out. And we also talked a lot about the benefits of brand advertising and how brand advertising can help call to action campaigns.
Yes.
You know, because an advertiser
stack on each other, right?
Yeah, an advertiser takes a call to action campaign, they build up frequency and recognition and familiarity, you know, peaks and then it drops off again. Yeah. So their awareness is down to zero again.
Totally.
Whereas if you've got brand advertising and you've got brand awareness, you know, running right throughout the year, when you run a call to action campaign, you've already got that base.
Yeah.
Of brand awareness, so your call to action campaign will have that much more impact, and probably be more cost efficient. So we did a lot of it was pretty much educational in terms of, you know, how to use branding and the importance of branding and why this very cost efficient product would work for advertisers.
And back in the day, there wasn't a lot of people teaching people about that sort of stuff.
Not at all.
You know, I've been doing this for a number of years now, and we've sort of come up with a formula: consistency, a message plus frequency of reach to create relevancy.
Yep.
And it's really important that you become relevant. And the struggle with a lot of, they don't give themselves that brand recognition or have those call to actions to become relevant, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
They're inconsistent with their message. They don't know what they never say who they are, where they are, and why people should do business with them,
exactly, right?
and what their offer is. So it would have been I guess people would have just been thirsty for that whole information side of things, because that game was back in the day was very much the top end of town held all the
secrets,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we could see big opportunities in those mid-level and even, you know, SMEs, which really, you know, at the end of the day, was the core of our business.
Yeah.
And because, you know, in those days, there were some quite sophisticated advertisers who had put a lot of effort into learning about advertising and maybe even had, you know, their own advertising manager. But there are a whole lot of businesses out there, you know, to whom radio was a bit of a mystery. And there wasn't a lot of education.
Yeah.
So a big part of what we did is tried to educate those, you know, smaller to medium-sized clients on, you know, on how to use radio, and there needn't be any mystique about it, because a lot of our competitors, a lot of stations used to go out and talk about, you know, talk a lot of jargon, basically, you know, in terms of, and that ended up confusing people.
Yeah,
and we used to go out and say, look, it's really simple, you know, reach the right people with the right message, with the right frequency, and that's it. You know, your campaign is done. It's not there's nothing all that complicated about it, and we can help, you know, help you learn about that and help teach that. And also we went to a lot of trouble to make sure the campaigns work, because, you know, a lot of radio people in those days, and probably even now, it's all about the sale.
Yeah.
Whereas from our point of view, it was all about the results.
The results.
Because if you don't get the results, if you've got a one-off customer, that probably never comes back and says radio doesn't work. So a big part of what we did is said, if we get these people on, even if they're at a relatively small budget, we're going to make that work for them.
Yeah.
So if they didn't have a very big budget, we might run a campaign over 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, if it was call to action to get the frequency over a shorter time frame than try and spread it too far,
which still wouldn't work, right?
No, exactly. Yeah. So
did, what was the name of that product? Did you give it another?
We didn't give that. That was really just part of our focus on delivering results. You know,
so good for advertising. So what was happening with the staff side of things there? How were you incentivizing your teams at that time? Were you doing anything special there?
We had, Well, all the staff are on a profit share. From the receptionist up. I mean,
how did that work? Like, that made profit, you got share, or how was that?
Yeah, it was done on the basis of, you know, people got so many shares based on their remuneration.
Yep.
And the rationale behind that was people who are on the higher remuneration should have had more impact on the profitability of the company.
Cool.
And one of the things we were very open about, we were open with our staff about revenue, about profit, you know, about costs. You know, we're very transparent in terms of of the whole operation. So the receptionist would know what revenue we generated month by month, you know, how it compared to last month. They'd know about where the costs were going.
That would have been like that would have been revolutionary.
Probably was, but it's common sense when you think about it, because if staff are informed, you know, they know as much about what's happening within the company as any, and it was a private company.
Yes.
So we didn't have, you know, external shareholders we had to provide reports to or whatever. So we were able to be as open with staff as we wanted to be.
Yeah. Did you find that more buy-in because of that?
I think so. I think so. And the profit share, you know, we wanted, at the end of the day, one of the things we said in our business philosophy is that the company doesn't, we don't own the company, you own the company.
Nice.
Because it's what you do that'll make it successful, not what we do. Yeah. One person, you know, okay, we might be able to help with creating the right strategy and the right environment.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it's the people that actually go out and do it.
What size of company were you, was that then? You just kind of...
Well, we started off at Moore FM in Wellington. We had about 30 staff. And then, well, across all the stations in the end, I don't know, we would have had 100 and something, 120, 130.
Brilliant.
And we also liked, we didn't pay the highest salaries in the business, but we tried to, you know, add other benefits. Profit share was one of them.
Yeah.
And profit share, you know, ended up being probably about 20% of their income was
in
profit share.
Nice.
So it was material. But we also took them on, we took all our staff to London. We took all our staff to Hawaii. We took all our staff to Indonesia, Phuket. And
was that with the clients or was that?
No, that was just staff. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it wasn't a sales exercise. It was purely staff. And
life changing for some people, right?
Took them to the Gold Coast, Sunshine Coast, Queenstown. But then they never knew from year to year. You know, one year we did a trip to Otaki, which is an hour up the road to the local pub at Otaki. You know, the next year we might have done London. So they never, because it never became an expectation.
Yes.
But our rationale was that it was good business sense.
How'd you keep the
Otaki? Because
how did you keep the Otaki one silent?
Well, I never knew where they were going. Year on year, they had no idea where they were going. And so it never became an expectation.
Yeah.
But our rationale was that, you know, we didn't pay the highest wages, salaries, but we looked after staff in other ways.
Mm.
And those things create memories. You give people extra money, and what happens to it? They spend it on groceries, electricity, paying the mortgage. You take someone to London or Hawaii, what are you doing? You're creating memories.
Yeah.
And just a couple of months ago, I was talking to an old radio guy. He said, "Oh, remember that trip we did to Bali?" And he recounted the story about what happened,
you know,
and I thought to myself, you know, that's 30, 40 years ago.
Oh, that's
and so 30 years ago. And here's someone who's that sitting in the back of his mind, a great memory from that particular trip.
Yeah.
But it meant that staff retention, I mean, the cost of hiring new staff is enormous.
Yes.
And you, there's every chance you get it wrong.
Yes,
try. You
know, yeah, no, definitely.
Every chance you get it wrong. So holding on to the people you've got is just so important.
Yeah.
And we had the lowest staff turnover of any radio station in the country by a big margin.
But just logistically, how did you do it? Was it a certain time of year you did that? Because you can't get all your staff out of your business.
Like. No. Well, we'd hire and we did it. We'd make sure it was obviously out of a survey period.
Yep.
The salespeople, because they were on commission, they sold ahead. And we had a skeleton staff that remained behind. And we rewarded them. And we gave them the option, you know, if anyone either can't go or doesn't want to go, then we rewarded them in other ways.
Brilliant.
So we had a skeleton staff, but we had no salespeople. We had a receptionist, we had on-air staff, and that was pretty much it.
Nice.
For a week. You know, and if you plan that, you can do it.
Yeah.
But the other advantage was that we never had to advertise for staff. because we were seen as a desirable company to work for.
Word of mouth would have just.
So we had people, we had a list of people who wanted to work for us.
Yeah.
And if you can create that sort
that's
of
goal.
Situation, it's brilliant because you've got some top talent that you know are good, available when somebody does leave. So there was a good business rationale behind it as well.
Where did you get, like, it's a real mindset, right? Where did you learn to, were you always interested in developing people and trying?
Absolutely. I learned very early on in radio. I mean, the capital is nothing. I mean, it might cost you a bit, but at the end of the day, your business, the people. And when people walk out the door at 6 or 7 o'clock at night, that's your business walking out the door.
Yeah.
You know, I might say, hey, I've got a great strategy, but that's pretty meaningless. I can't actually implement that. I can't make that work.
Mm.
So it's just logic. The business is the people. It's not like, a retail outlet where you've got a whole lot of products.
Yeah.
And if people want that product, they come in and buy it.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't that many people sitting, waiting, queuing up to buy radio advertising because there's so many choices.
Yeah, true.
So, I learned very early on that staff are pretty much everything in terms of, a media business and sort of develop that philosophy on people, get the best people and give them the freedom to do what they do best.
I love it. I love it. Such a good philosophy, especially in an environment that's probably at the time completely opposite. Some of your competitors would have been
exactly. Yeah, opposite, right? They were very structured and hierarchical, and bureaucratic. And I don't know, creatives in any industry, radio is a creative industry. Creatives need a bit of room to move.
Yeah, they do.
They don't respond well to being told what to do or being told to do it this particular way.
No.
Because there are lots of different ways to achieve the same end result.
Yeah.
And look, I don't know, it just developed over time, I guess. And part of it was the way I was treated, in Radio New Zealand, where, as I said, they spent a lot of money training me.
Yeah.
And then, I became general manager of TZM and they put me in a straitjacket.
Yeah. It's kind of,
sit and you make you a puppet manager. And I'm thinking, they give me all this training, to be a good manager. And once you get there, they're saying you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do something else.
Crazy.
So I always made up my mind that, if I was ever in that position, that I would look at it quite differently and take it.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And you got that opportunity. So how long did you have More FM for? Like, what was your...
We set it up, started in 1991. It didn't have it for that long, sold it in 1998. Ken West, the owners of TV3 at the time, they came knocking and we turned them back 3 or 4 times. I can't remember because we weren't really ready to sell.
Yep.
They came back and at the end of the day, they came back and with an offer that, as they say, an offer we couldn't refuse.
Yeah, nice.
But at the same time, I was looking at what became NRS Media. We were starting to do a bit of work offshore with Mike, who you've already interviewed.
Yeah, yeah.
And Brian Duffy. And so we were already starting to develop that business while I was still running More FM. And I could see opportunities, with that business. I could see, bigger opportunities, I guess, and because it had everywhere we did what we did, and it was basically a flow on from that seminar model that we created at More FM.
Yeah,
everywhere we did it, it worked, and so I could see, international opportunities with that.
Nice.
So I started to, really start to. I thought this is a good opportunity. More FM has, has done, really well. And while we would have liked to have held on to it for, 4 or 5 years, it wasn't a bad time to sell and focus more effort on NRS Media, which proved to be, in the end, a sensible decision.
Looking back at More FM, what was the biggest takeaway you took away from,
getting that business, you know, buying the frequency to having it for 7 or 8 years and selling it. What was your biggest takeaway there?
The biggest takeaway for me was that that you've always got to challenge traditional thinking. And we More FM did things differently. So everything we did, you know, we tried to look at what everybody else was doing and say, is there a better way of doing this? Okay. Is there a way that will have more impact? And ever since, you know, my mindset has always been about challenging traditional thinking. And it's not necessarily always the big things.
Yeah.
It's often little things. I mean, when we launched a new station, you know, we gave salespeople business cards. Mm. Well, you know, everybody has business cards. Yeah. But our business cards were A4 size business cards.
Really?
You know, so they were briefcase size business cards. So, you know, when someone went into a client and said, oh, can I leave my business card? And they said, yeah, you know, and they bring up these huge with their name on and, you know, and the station on. And those business cards would sit pinned up on cork boards and on clients' desks for months after.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was more than that. It was about saying, hey, you know, this company's non-conventional. This company's does things differently. This company is...
Which if you're hiring them for a creative reason, that's what you kind of want.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
You want that yourself,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So it's part of the perception. So by challenging traditional thinking, instead of actually doing... And I'm not saying traditional thinking doesn't work, because it does. But sometimes, you know, if you really look at something and say, hey, there's a different way of doing it. You know, like the seminar sales.
Yeah, true.
You know, that different way of selling to small to medium-sized clients when you've got a single product that you can promote in a seminar forum.
How did you look at traditional thinking and challenge it? Did you sit down as a team and brainstorm?
Absolutely. Nobody's got a monopoly on ideas.
Yeah.
So everybody from the receptionist up, you know, we used to brainstorm things all the time, and there were only two rules. You know, one is that, you know, no idea is stupid.
Yep.
You know, say what you like. But the big one was nobody's allowed to criticize. Nobody's allowed to say this won't work.
Yeah.
And we had a yellow card and a red card system. And if someone criticized once and said, oh, you know, I don't think that'll work, then they got a yellow card. And if they criticized twice, they got a red card and they were gone.
Brilliant.
Because you've got to create, you've got to have an environment where people can feel free. And I've, you know, as I said before, I've made more mistakes in the industry than anyone else I know. Because you've got to test the boundaries.
Yeah.
And you can only do that when you've got an environment in which people feel absolutely comfortable saying whatever they want to say. And then somebody else would spark off that and say, well, you know, I think we could do it this way, or I think I could add to that.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, with that collective group, something comes out of it. Special.
Yeah. So let's just go through that example. So someone puts down the business card and you look at that from a traditional thinking perspective.
Yeah.
And then someone says, hey, why don't we create it as an A4?
Yeah, exactly.
And everyone goes, let's give that a go.
Yeah.
You know, or you brainstorm it and look at
exactly.
it. How good.
So it starts out with, you know, how do we create a different business card? And somebody says, you know, let's put a holograph on it or something like that.
Yeah.
And somebody else says, well, yeah, that's a good idea. But maybe we should put something on the back, you know, a nice little saying or phrase or, you know, about advertising or whatever, you know, like reach the right people with them.
Yeah,
with the right message at the right frequency, you know, maybe put that on the back. Somebody else says, oh, well, you know, wouldn't it have a lot more impact if it was a big business card?
Yeah.
You know, with the rep's name and, you know,
so good.
Huge letters. So it evolves.
It evolves, yeah.
You know, from and
but it must be some fun times though. Like,
oh, brilliant. Yeah, amazing. I mean, staff, we had some unbelievable staff. And I mean, we're pretty lucky, I think, and we just managed to get that group of people together that just worked.
Yeah.
All different personalities, very different personalities. But it was the same in all of the More FM stations, you know, Wellington, Christchurch, Dunedin, Hawke's Bay, everywhere. Auckland. And we gave the general manager a lot of freedom as well.
Yep.
I just don't believe in being too prescriptive.
Yeah. Well, you could see that it didn't work for you, right? And you knew that it wasn't going to.
And, you know, that doesn't work for every company, but it sure as hell worked for us.
What a great takeaway to leave from that business. You know, like you've sold it for a good amount of money, but your takeaway, you know, going into the next business as well, you can take that takeaway and jump into what you're doing there. Did you end up taking, or did part of the deal, you know, obviously being they had staff there, but when you started the new company, did people start to find out, hey, where you guys are gone and what?
Yeah, yeah.
All of a sudden want to go.
Yeah, we had a lot of, we're very careful. I mean, one of the things I did when we sold More FM, and we lived in France for 3 years because I thought I want to get a complete break.
Brilliant.
I don't want people ringing up, you know, old staff ringing up saying, oh, it's not the same,
yeah.
You know, because that's a potential problem.
Yeah.
And I always said to them, you know, it's not the same. You know, it's different, but different doesn't necessarily mean worse.
Mm.
You know, it's just different.
Yeah.
There are things that they will do that are better than things that I did.
Yeah.
For sure.
Totally.
So just embrace it. But I didn't want to get caught up in that. So we took basically a complete break.
Nice.
And I did a lot of work on NRS at the time.
Yep.
You know, while we were in France. So we didn't take any staff from, and the other thing I was very conscious of is that, you know, Canwest had paid, you know, a very good price. And while there was no legal obligation, you know, not to poach staff or whatever, I didn't want to take any staff from there. Yeah, in the first years, and to be fair, it was called Persuaders in those days.
Yeah,
it was a very small company anyway, so we didn't have only had a few staff, so we didn't really have a lot of staff.
Yeah,
opportunities later on, staff from More FM.
So the idea behind NRS Media, what was your core business that you were doing there? You mentioned seminars and others.
Yeah, well, it started out as. When I left, Windy a year before we bid for the frequencies. And in that year, I needed to get some income, obviously, because the government had already flagged that they were going to open up the frequencies. No one quite knew when, and we thought it might be halfway through the year.
Yeah.
And I think I said 6 months that I left before.
Yeah.
It was actually 12 months. That I gave Windy 6 months notice, and then 12 months before the frequencies came up for tender, and I did consultancy work in that time.
Yeah,
and I had some clients in New Zealand, but I thought to get a reasonable amount of income, I really need to look at Australia as well. So
yeah.
So I did some consultancy work in Australia, and when we got the frequencies. I'd had this consultancy business sitting over here that was generating, good income, but I was 100% focused on More FM. So I went to Brian Duffy, who I worked with at Windy, and he's one of the partners in NRS, and said, Brian, I've got all this consultancy work. Would you be interested in entering into a partnership? And I'll provide some of the strategic overview and provide some input, but you deal directly with the clients and do the consultancy work. So we did that and that worked well for a couple of years. But radio companies don't like paying consultants, number one.
Yeah.
So it was always pushed back when it came to, renewing your contract or whatever. And as part of the service we provided, we offered innovative revenue generating concepts. We offered ideas that they'd never tried before, that most of which we'd tried at More FM and proven to be successful. We started putting some of these in, and they generated a huge a lot of money for the media company. So one media partner said, "Look," he said, "I don't want to pay the consultancy, but I'm happy to pay you a commission."
Yeah.
And the revenue you generate.
Brilliant.
So we came to the conclusion that our business shouldn't be a consultancy business, which is very time intensive.
Yeah.
And, we got reasonable income from it, but it was pretty time intensive. We thought, you know, really, we should be in the business of generating revenue for media companies and taking a commission, because there was never any pushback.
Yeah.
You know, they actually came to us and said, look, we'll pay you a commission on all the revenue on all these ideas you put up. So that's how
brilliant.
How, you know, how that developed.
And you didn't then have to have the delivery model there either. Like you sold what their package is. Did you package up their package?
Yeah, but we created processes around it. Yeah. And that's really the driver. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, good ideas are relatively easy.
Yeah.
What you need is a system to drive them.
System.
So we had what we called the front end and the back end. You know, the front end were the creative ideas. The back end was the engine that drove those, you know.
Yep.
It's a seminar sales model. Then, you know, you've got all these systems and processes that sit in behind that.
Nice.
To make sure it's successful. So while we were offering some of our consultancy clients these revenue generating concepts, at the same time we were creating systems around them, because we really had to be a paint by numbers.
Yeah,
you know, you put them in there and you say, hey, here's what you got to do to make this work. So we created these.
Looking at this going, think we're going to take this global? Like, is that what we were?
Yeah, I thought the opportunity was there, but it's pretty hard. You know, there's always a lot of. Not criticism, but there's always a lot of feeling that you're from New Zealand, you're from a small company, how can you know more than we do? So it was always a bit of a battle, but I could always see opportunities. And, you know, we got into the States and we lost some money in the States to start with, but we managed to get some clients in the States, and that was really the springboard.
Yeah.
Once we got in there, we then got into the UK.
What were some of the keys to your success there? Like, what was your?
Well, we had a product that worked.
Yep.
And we'd done it in enough different markets that we were confident if people followed the formula, and we were there to make sure they did, we were there and to provide support. If they followed the formula, you know, the results would come. And we got it to a point where we could pretty much predict plus or minus 10% what sort of revenue they were going to generate. So we could go in there and say, we reckon.
The seminar model.
So
how many people in the room you knew kind of?
We created some metrics around that that gave us a pretty good idea of what sort of revenue potential was in each market. So we were able to go in there and say, we think this market's worth whatever, and we understated it a bit, so that we always overperformed.
Looked good,
and so we knew the product would work. And once we got into the States, you know, the States is a hard market to get into, but I tell you what, they're really good at referrals. You know, you do something and it works, and they say, hey, you should go and talk to this guy,
nice,
or you should go and talk to this guy, or I'll ring him.
Yeah.
And let him know he needs to talk to
Brilliant. Him. And so were you dealing with the radio?
Radio to start with, but then we got into television. In fact, in the States, the biggest market was television, because over there, television is more local.
Mm.
You know, these local television stations that rely on local direct revenue. So
were you looking at a new way of selling as well? The products that you were packaging, I mean, we're talking to Mike, and you see like some advertising was sold in, say, a 6-week pack, and more of a longer term.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then once again, educating the market on the, you know, the brand and also the call to actions. And so that was the formula.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, people said, oh, you know, you can't sell 12-month contracts, and you sure as hell can't sell them within the space of, you know, a 20-minute seminar or a 20-minute presentation. But the fact is you can, if the product is right, if the offer is right, the product is right, and, you know, you've got the presentation that covers all the objections that people might have, and also you create scarcity and urgency.
Yeah.
You know, you can. And
so
we
good. Yeah. And then the radio guys, all the team, all these media channels must have loved you guys coming in.
Yeah, they did.
Because there was no risk then, right? Whenever you guys sold, they got a cart and you got a cart.
Yeah, we had, exactly. It was a typical win-win situation, because, you know, the the risk, there was no risk to them, yeah. No.
And obviously paint by numbers as well, so you systemized it, so yep. it could be set anywhere, right?
Absolutely.
So yeah. What countries were you in? Like, yeah, obviously in the States, you went to London.
Okay, we're in South America, we're in three or four countries in Brilliant. South America, Brazil, Argentina, Colombia. We had an office in Bogota in Colombia.
Yeah, good.
And Chile, we were in Chile.
Were you selling licenses to those areas or you were operating?
No, we were operating ourselves, yeah. Wow. Quality control was really, yeah. But to be fair, in South America, it was mostly serviced out of the US.
Yeah.
They'd fly down and do
brilliant.
Do a gig there. So we were in Canada, obviously. We had a big office in Toronto.
Were you guys living up there at the time or were you operating from New Zealand?
No, still operating from New Zealand. Mike used to go up over to the States when we first started in the States. He'd spend 2 or 3 months at a time yep. in the States and come back. But no, we were still based in New right. Zealand. We're in heaps of European countries
yep.
And Eastern European as well as Western European countries. Obviously the UK and Ireland, South Africa.
So
big footprint in South Africa, Namibia,
And getting to that level, you're obviously you're starting to create waves in that industry. Were people then starting to look at you guys and go, hey, what are these guys up to? And did you start getting some offers rolling in?
Yeah, that's the old story. You know, people, you know, talked about fear of failure before,
yeah.
and it hasn't. You know, I've failed lots of times, but the funny thing is that even if there's no risk. You know, a lot of media companies say, oh, what if it doesn't work?
Yeah.
You know, even though the risk is
not really on them.
Not on them. You know, so they didn't want to do it in case, you know, it didn't work, in case they had to go to their board and, oh, yeah, well, I don't know why. But once you get a track record,
yeah,
then, you've got credibility, people know it works, and then, you know, word of mouth got around, people, particularly those. And the other thing is we got given all the poor performing stations,
yep,
because they were the ones that were in trouble. So we worked with most of the major media companies in the US and the UK, but we got their poor performing stations.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they didn't give us the good ones. They gave us the ones that were struggling.
Great to be able to turn that around, though, right?
Yeah, like yeah. It was good. You know, and we generated, you know, in some cases, you know, we generated over 50% of their annual revenue in,
yeah.
you know, in 1 week. Not a big base to start from, to be fair. I mean, they were performing pretty badly, but that go around, and so, you know, we got a lot of stations that were in trouble,
yeah,
saying, hey, can you help us? So yeah, so we did have that snowball effect.
Brilliant. So any particular clients stick out for you? The stories that come to mind when in the media game for you, like any favorites that you've dealt with over the years?
Yeah, South African clients were brilliant. I mean,
yeah.
We went into South Africa cold. We had no business there. And, you know, we went into South Africa and we got a number of key clients there, you know, Prime Media, which is the biggest media company in South Africa. We got Algoa FM and
OFM. Do you just rock up there?
No, we did a lot of big communication strategy. Yep. Look, it's no different than selling anything. You've got to make, you've got to build credibility. You've got to have a communication strategy.
Oh.
You've got to have, you know, the traditional 7 points of contact, yeah. you know, so we did a lot of work
building up.
But some of those clients stayed with us they were with us until we sold the company.
Brilliant.
And a lot of them are still personal friends that keep in touch with. So
nice.
So I think, you know, the South African clients were brilliant, but you know, and we had some great clients in the US, you know, the US as well. Well, everywhere really. Yeah.
Different challenges and different, all those different areas too.
That they are, but the principles remain the same.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if a product works and the process works, then it will work anywhere. You might need to adapt certain things to suit the market. There were market differences. But, you know, you go into a market and you talk to manager or the salespeople, they say our market is different.
Yes.
You know, every market, every is, market different. Is
different. Yeah.
But in reality, you know, if you if you have a system and you know you do things right, you know, it'll work.
What do you say then to, you know, inspiring your young business owners or even just business owners? You know, they've got some ideas and they're thinking, well, what would be your advice, knowing what you know now? You know, built up, you know, two successful companies and exited them, and you're still in the game doing stuff. Like,
we're setting up a new company at the moment. Yeah. So,
What do you say to the? What's your some of your advice for the people these days? Because media's got definitely, you know, like, I remember talking to Mike Jones from Novus, a client of ours for 9 years now. When he first started out, there was one radio, one TV station.
You know? Yeah.
Now look how disjointed, or how fragmented that all is, right? Like, there's so much people can do, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Look, you know, I think the thing in any business is, you know, is to stick with it. I mean, if you've got a good idea, it mightn't always work the first time. And we had some trial and experimentation with what we did. But you know, just because it doesn't work once doesn't mean to say it's not going to work.
No.
And so you know, you got to be prepared to, you know, to stick with something. And if it's conceptually sound,
yeah,
you know, just keep going until you can make it work.
Yeah.
And you've got to have, and also think, you know, I'm a great believer in challenging traditional thinking, not getting rid of what worked in the past simply because it is traditional, but looking at how you can do it better or how you can build on traditional thinking. Because if you want to create something different and you want to make a mark, you know, in business, you've got to have a point of difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if you just keep doing the same as all your competitors are doing, then you could do okay. But if you really want to take your business, you know, to another level and expand it, you know, you really have to have a point of difference. You have to promote it well. You have to do the basics well.
Mm.
You know, it's a combination of all those things. And above all, you know, you have to have good people to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah. And get out of the way.
Like, yeah, and get out of the way.
Give them the boundaries, the parameters, as you said. I think that's really, really, really key. Point of difference is key too. You know, sitting down and actually thinking why people should buy from us. What are we doing that's different here? Looking at, as you say, those little things. I was saying small hinges swing big doors.
Yeah.
It's always the little things that you can look at, you know, and think some thinking time around that. I don't think enough time is spent thinking these days, you know.
No, I agree.
So what do you do? What are you looking at now? Is that top secret, or are you working on a few things?
No, we're looking at a completely different sales model for media. I mean, the seminar sales, you know, have reached their use by date.
Yeah.
They it's like anything, you know, when we first did it was so exciting.
Yes.
You know, we'd go into, I can't think of a market that we went into where we didn't have a waiting list.
Yeah.
You know, waiting list of advertisers if someone drops out.
Yeah.
You know, and the success rates, you know, we would get 60 or 70% of the people who said they would turn up. We'd get 60 or 70% of those people buying.
Mm.
Now, you know, you might get 30% turn up. Because it's, you know, it's now old hat. It's now everybody knows these offers, you know, come into the market.
Yeah.
They're time poor. They know what they're going to be exposed to, and they don't necessarily like to be, you know, sold to in that type of environment.
Yeah.
And also there's quite a lot of time involved in organizing it, building databases, and there is some time off the road for the salespeople, albeit only one week. And that's fine if you're getting the results. When the results start to decline, you got to look at saying, well, hey, this is not working the way it was. You know, it's never sold out on the. We used to sell out on the, you know, during the day or during the week. It never sold out. Even when we sold the company, we could see that it was starting to get there. So I mean, with Mike and another ex NRS guy, Roy Hawker, we've been looking and saying, hey, you know, how can we turn that upside down?
Yeah.
How can we eliminate all those negatives?
Yeah.
You know, the time involved in seminars, the you know, the lower response rates, time off the road for salespeople. And there is a cost involved in, you know, running a seminar. Yeah,
totally.
And you have to do, you know, you can only do it once for 1 week. So how do we turn that upside down? So we've created a company called Inbound Media Sales.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about inbound sales, which is all done remotely. So so sales coming into the media company, not the media company going out.
Coming out, nice.
And no media company in the world is doing it at the moment. So a lot of it revolves around content. You know, we've got the Common Sense Guide to Radio Advertising that works. So we provide content, you know, to new and lapsed advertisers. You know, they in turn interact by downloading the radio guide, and then we've got a whole lot of other content.
Nice.
So we draw them in, and then we can make an offer to them. So so we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, exciting to see a new model though. Like, you know, it's
It's completely different. It's turned the old model upside down.
Yeah.
And to be fair, you know, seminar when we first started the seminar methodology. I mean, that was really new in a way that revolutionized the way radio was sold.
Totally.
Every station or every media company in the world now has their own version of that.
Yes.
They didn't necessarily use NRS Media.
No.
They'd steal the idea and do it themselves. So so that sort of but it really has got to a point where performance is declining and you know, sales are declining, tenants rates are declining, so it's time to look at something completely different.
Nice. So, you, from your own point of view, you've written a couple of books now as well. Like,
that's a bit of a hobby. I mean, I've always loved writing, so I've written a couple of books that seem to have done pretty well. So
nice.
Yeah.
And what sort of space have they been in?
They're true World War II stories. I did write a business book about 20 years ago
called
Fun as a Serious Business.
Nice.
Because, you know, I think fun in the workplace is
a serious business.
Is a critical component.
Yeah.
And that's what we tried to create at More FM. People spend more time at work than they do doing anything else.
I want to read that.
So I'll send you a copy.
Brilliant.
Because if you can have fun in the workplace, it just creates a different environment. It takes away a lot of the stress and pressure, and people can have a laugh.
Yeah,
laugh at themselves. You know, laugh at me because I deserve it. that's a good. It's a good environment for people to be in. So fun as a serious business. That was a business book I wrote 20. I can't remember, a long time ago.
That's outstanding.
But I've written a couple of true World War II stories
that
I've seen published in various countries. So
that's brilliant. And then this has been a fascinating chat. Like one thing I probably want to, as we wrap this up, is this thing here would be a group of, you know, we've got a lot of business owners listening. What would you say to them about, you know, looking at their advertising and marketing these days? What are some of the things you think they should be looking at?
Well, I think, you know, the critical thing is, you know, with any advertising or marketing, be consistent.
Mm.
You know, consistent message. You might change the offer, but, but be consistent. So, you know, it's a, and also, you know, whether that's the jingle, whether that's the same voice, whether that's the same background effects or whatever, make sure that people can instantly recognize who that advertiser is, and do it for years, not months.
Yeah,
the thing about it is, you know, by the time a business person is getting sick of it, that's about the time it's starting to work.
Yes.
So you need to be consistent. You need to make sure that in any advertising, certainly in radio advertising, you can only promote one single benefit. Make sure you identify what it is about your business that that is that point of difference that does give people a reason to buy from you.
Yeah, because a confused mind never buys.
No, exactly right.
Yeah,
nice. So I think that that just getting across that single point and hammering away at it is just so critical, in any form of advertising and certainly on radio.
Yeah.
That's some good takeaways, right? So you know, be consistent. And honestly, that's the thing I see. People, they don't really give themselves enough runway to become that relevant person,
no,
that relevant company, because they're not consistent with it.
You've got to take the long-term view as well. I mean, yeah. You know, if all you ever do is run short bursts of advertising, sure, you know, you'll get some business, you know, in the door. But if you want to be a preferred brand, if you want to get good share of mind, you know, you need to take a long-term strategic approach.
Yeah.
And sometimes you don't always see the benefits. You don't always see the results straight up, particularly with brand advertising.
Yeah. Branding to me is like a marathon.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, it's a long, long, long game.
And you've got to be there. You know, you've got to pound it out and be consistent.
Yeah.
You know, all the way. It's just like a marathon. It's not about, you know, a whole series of sprints.
Yeah.
It's about actually going the distance.
Well, the marketing side of things more like the race, you know, like a series of sprints, you know.
Yeah,
you're saying with your different offers and those sort of things.
That's
you're thinking of breaking it up. Yeah, it's that's where the mindset comes in, like having that growth-focused mindset, being prepared to wait to some degree. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of business owners too, you know,
absolutely. Well,
where's my money? Where's my leads? You know?
And often they give up just when it's starting, when it's about starting to work. But, you know, the thing about it is if you build great brand awareness, it actually costs you less in the long run.
Yeah.
Your advertising budget is actually less in the long run because you've built that familiarity and recognition and, you've got that brand perception, and that's a huge asset to any business.
Yeah.
In fact, it's probably one of the most valuable assets that a business has is brand recognition.
Well, I always say to people, you know, when we do seminars and that workshops and stuff, you know, if I say the word soft drink, you think
exactly.
Coca-Cola, right? Exactly, and if I say the word fast food, you think McDonald's. But then if I say your brand, you know, like cars Christchurch or heat pumps Christchurch. Yeah. Who do people think of? I want to get people thinking about it. To grow a market share, you've got to grow a mind share.
Exactly.
And the cool thing about it today is you don't have to spend Coke or McDonald's money right? Because of the targeting you can have with these platforms today. So
and every brand can be just as well known and recognized in their local market as big international brands. I mean,
massive opportunity.
Exactly. I mean, you can be just as well known in Canterbury or Christchurch or Wellington or wherever as any of the major international brands.
To the people that can and want to buy your product too, right?
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
It's a game changer.
But I remember, you know, just in terms of, you know, how you place advertising. When we launched New State, because all of our stations were launched from nothing, you know, just a frequency and no market recognition and perception. You know, I used to look at it and say, okay, how much do I think we're going to spend in 3 years? And I spent half of that in the first year.
Brilliant.
Half of that in the first year and then, you know, a lesser amount in years two or three.
Yeah.
Because getting that brand awareness up quickly was just so critical.
Yeah, that's a great takeaway.
Yeah, just so critical and didn't cost us any more over 3 years.
No.
But we poured the bulk of it in to start with because we needed to get that you know, promotion and whatever. And even with a normal radio campaign, I always tell advertisers to front load.
Yep.
You know, if you're going to run 50 spots, you know, over a week, do 25 in the first two or three days.
Yep.
So that you get that frequency up early, because it's a bit like when you hear a new song. First time you hear a new song, you know, you don't know the artist, you know, you don't know the title, you don't know the words.
Yeah.
And it's unfamiliar. By the time you've heard that song four or five times, you know, you're starting to hum along, you know, at least half the words, and it's starting to become a favorite.
Yeah.
Well, advertising works in exactly the same way.
Yeah, because it builds know, like, and trust.
Yeah, exactly. You know? When you build that familiarity and recognition quickly, the quicker you do it, the more quickly your advertising is going to work, sure.
Great takeaway to leave on, I think, guys. Hey, really appreciate you coming in, Dave.
That's right.
I know you're a busy man, and obviously, you know, it's great to have your experience and just listening to, you know, something I think – one of the takeaways I'm takeaway here is your world-class mindset around attracting and employing good people.
Absolutely.
And being, and I think, you know,
Now, that takes a really cool mindset to be able to do that and to not have to have the ego that it was all about you, you know. And I think that's what I love the takeaway today is, you know, grow good people, but do some really good stuff with them too, you know.
Yeah.
We created a hashtag here a few years ago called Celebrate Your Victories, and we love to do that here.
Because you're here a long time each day,
you know, make sure your work is fun. So yep, I appreciate absolutely. You coming along and sharing your wisdom.
Happy to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So good. Hey guys. So thank you. I'll put some, where people can get a hold of you. We'll put some details on the, Are you happy to talk to people?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Nice. All right. That's good to hear. Hey, and maybe we can sell some more of your books. Are they still in print or?
I've got some at home.
Mike's always sending me his books.
He's a big self promoter.
I always give them away. People need to know about sales. Definitely.
Yeah, I
look forward to reading your book. So, hey, really appreciate your time. Guys and girls, thank you for listening to the Marketing the Business podcast. This has been a great episode. I think this is one you really should share. So please do that for us. Just share the podcast with another business owner. You know, the community is growing. We're getting more and more downloads every month. I think today we just reached again into the top five for New Zealand for marketing. So we're really starting to snowball and people are getting a lot of value. So really appreciate. Make sure you give this guy a follow. Check him out. We'll have all the details in the show notes here. And once again, thanks for your time. Have fun. And remember, as always, take action. Hi, Scott Wilson here again. Hey, thanks for listening to the Marketing for Business podcast. We really appreciate you taking the time to listen. And we hope that you learned a lot from today's episode. If you could be so kind as to rate and share the podcast with your other business friends and colleagues, that'd be awesome. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, why don't you head over to our website, www.getdigitalinfluence.com, where we've got a whole bunch of other amazing interviews with business owners. Thanks for your time and have a great day.